Well, welcome into the Chris Collinsworth podcast. We have my guys from PFF. We've got Seth Galina, Trevor Sikkema. Welcome, guys. Thanks for coming on.
I appreciate it, Chris. Anytime.
Just got back from the owners' meeting, which is always a fantastic time. We get to hobnob with all the coaches and owners. And congratulations to Robert Kraft, newly engaged Robert Kraft, and engaged to Dr. Dana Bloomberg. Congratulations. I will tell no stories beyond that. Also, congratulations. You guys know how much I want to tell these stories. Also, congratulations to Jerry Jones' wife, Jean, who had her diamond jubilee. If you want to figure out how old she is, look that one up on the internet. I'm not going to give away that tip either. So everybody was happy. Everything was fantastic. We got to go on Jerry's big yacht. That is, you'd have to see it to believe it. So pretty incredible week and weekend for us down there. But more than that, I got a chance to play golf at Seminole Golf Course, which is one of the great country clubs in the country, and also Michael Jordan's The Grove 23. Now, let me tell you about The Grove 23. The Grove 23 is, so it's Michael's course, and it's a links course. And so you go out there, and Michael's literally behind the practice range, heckling you as you're hitting balls, and, you know, because none of us know how to play golf the right way. But so just a fantastic guy. And he looks like a Greek god still. He's phenomenal how well he's built and all the different things that he does. But he hates to play slow, and he wants to play 36 holes every day. So the golf carts on this golf course, Grove 23, go 40 miles an hour. They had a guy who hit a sand trap at 40 miles an hour, did a front flip in his golf cart, and came out alive, survived the deal. So now when you come up to a sand trap, it's warning, Will Robinson, stop. So, you know, it does all that. But the four caddies who were in charge of finding the balls that I hit everywhere on this friggin' golf course, they're on motorcycles with the tires that are about this wide. And the minute that everybody's hit their drive, this guy is like a rocket, takes off down the fairway and is going around to find all these different golf balls. It is like between all the things that I saw this past week, I'm like, there is the world, and then there is that world that those guys lived in. And it was unbelievable. I mean, when Michael Jordan, so here's the deal. Michael's playing 36 holes a day. So when he comes up behind your group, you just step aside. You get to watch him play through and play, and then you get to play in behind. But he will not be stopped on his own golf course. He's going to zip around and do it. And apparently Michael has the reputation, you know, what his reputation was playing ball. You know, he was, you know, either he's going to love them or he was going to grind these guys away. Apparently for all 36 holes, he's not talking. He's playing for the money. He'll take any bet against anybody at any time. And he is grinding these guys. It looks like one of those chess matches with the guys growling at each other across from the chessboard as he's going around this golf course in 40 mile an hour golf carts with motorcycle escorts going down the side to find. It's the darndest thing you've ever seen in your whole life.
Forget the speed. My lower back couldn't take 36 holes a day of golf. Like if I did that for 2 days straight, my back would be screaming, and I just turned 31. So, you know, I guess that's, Seth, I would say that the only difference between me and Michael Jordan is, you know, the stamina of our lower back. That's probably fair, right? That's probably the only difference between Michael Jordan and I.
I hope that we take that quote and put it on Twitter. Trevor Sikkema says the only difference between himself and Michael Jordan is lower back health.
I'll stick with it. Put it on a graphic.
that and about 1.5999 billion dollars, somewhere in between there, the differences that we
yeah
have.
But if I had a better lower back, Chris, I would have you that 5.9 billion dollars. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, Trevor,
Michael
no
needs to
it.
consult with the people of college football so that we don't have 4.5 hour college football games anymore.
This is a great idea. Like, this is a great idea.
This is what he needs to use his talents to get a shorter college football game. So if he's Amen. Using his talents on the golf course to shorten up everyone's time per hole, he's got to get to the SEC people, to the ACC people.
I would vote for him for president if he could pull that off. I am totally, totally in agreement with that one. Speaking of extra time in the game of football, we have the rule change, right? So the basically what happened was in Buffalo, Kansas City, one of the most famous games. I think that's going to go down in history is one of the most famous games. The back and forth and who's going to win. And then Kansas City, Buffalo scores with whatever it was, 25 seconds to go. A couple plays later, here they go back down. And, you know, so anyway, it goes to overtime and Kansas City gets the ball. Kansas City goes right down the field and scores, which nobody had stopped anybody for the last 8 minutes of this game anyway. And so Kansas City wins the game. So today at the owners meeting, that's it. No more. Now we are guaranteed that even if one team scores a touchdown on the first possession, the other team is going to get a full possession. You like it?
I love it. I've been pounding the table for new overtime rules for forever, because as of right now, the coin flip just means way too much in this situation. And I think the record off the top of my head is, The team in the playoffs who has gotten the ball first is like 10-2. Like it's not even debatable that it has an unfair advantage, because the game has already evolved so much to where it favors offense over defense. When you get in these playoffs, especially into the divisional and the conference championship round, Super Bowl, of course, as well, these are the best offenses in the NFL. So you're supposed to take a game that's now tailored around offenses, take those best offenses, put them on the field, and now all of a sudden you're going to say to yourself, well, they got to stop the offense. I was never down with that. I think that both teams, I'm not trying to take away one side of the game, but I think that in that scenario, both teams should absolutely be able to possess the football. Now, if one team wins the coin toss, goes down, scores a touchdown, other team gets the ball, goes down, score a touchdown, and then the next team gets it, scores another touchdown after that, okay, it's fine. I'm fine with it. At that point, you will have allowed enough football to have been played to determine the winner of a football game, not the possession.
Plus, you could go for two if you chose to. You would have a chance to win it at the end of the game if you wanted to. Here's my one question, and I truly don't know the answer. I just saw this come across the wire. Is there going to be a difference between the regular season and the postseason? Because in the 10 minutes... Right. If it stayed the same way, and it was just a 10-minute overtime, you could have a 9-minute drive for one team and then the other team have a minute to score the other way. I don't know how they resolve that.
I think they're keeping it the same for the regular season, and this new thing is just going to be for the postseason. So that the scenario that you're talking about doesn't play out where you have a super long drive and only 10 minutes. So obviously in the postseason, it's unlimited timing. I think what you're talking about, the 2-point conversion, I think it's going to be super interesting. You know, if you score a touchdown, like, are you thinking, I don't think this would be smart, but you never know. You know, if you feel super confident, you know, going for two right away after you score the touchdown on the opening drive or whatever, whenever you score that opening touchdown in overtime, and trying to see if you can create that much, you know, the 8-point advantage early. I think this is the best way to go. I kind of think that college overtime, the way that it was for most of my life, before they changed it like last year or whatever.
The golden age. Yes.
Is probably my favorite. I'm not sure it's like the best way. I think it's for entertainment. I think that's the best because you get, you know, you're starting on the 30 or whatever, the 35. So you're going to get points and touchdowns kind of automatically, especially in the NFL, if you had NFL kickers there. And then you're just getting a lot of more football, right? That's for me, I'm always like, whatever gets me more football,
Except for college football. You don't want more college football. You want less college football.
He wants more of
Come on, Trevor. That's a double stack. That's a double standard that Seth is laying on.
He is. We're 4 minutes in the pod and Seth's already contradicted himself, so that's not good. But he wants more good college football, and I don't blame him. Something else that I would add to the overtime rules, which I've kind of just thought of this in my head, and I try to play devil's advocate with myself with rule changes, but – what if, because everybody's talking about the whole go for two thing, right? Can the team who scores first go for two and end the game or whatever? What if they would have done it where each team gets at least one possession, but no matter what, at any point in time in overtime, you have to go for two. Like, there's no point after attempts, right? And so it's almost like you really are challenging the team to be at its best. You got to score in the red zone, you got to score a touchdown, and then you got to score a 2-point conversion if you actually want to win the game. So I don't know. I'm still working out exactly the waterfalls of what would happen with that rule, but I kind of like it. Each team gets at least one possession, and there's no more point after attempts in overtime. You only have the option to go for two. You really got to go.
A step further.
Okay.
No more point after touchdowns, period.
Ever.
Like, what if we just, I'm like joking, but I'm not even joking that much, because I think that like the game would just be more fun if you had weirder scores and less kicking. Kicking is not fun. No one likes.
Well, okay. Hold on. Whoa. Field goals are kind of fun though.
Yeah. No? Like a long field goal is fun at the end of the game.
That's what I'm saying. You got to keep that part in the game.
Yeah. Field goals are fine. I'm just saying no extra points.
Okay.
Got to go for two.
I don't hate this. I think it opens up Pandora's box, but you know what? I'm ready to ride through chaos with you guys if you want to do it. So that I'd be willing to find out.
The second we take away extra points, the next thing we take away running plays, the next way we take away like
we're pretty close to that already. We're already pretty close on that. Yeah. You know, let's go back to the OT for just a second, because at the very least, right, it used to be if you won the coin toss, you took the ball every time. Mm-hmm. I think now in OT, maybe at least during the playoffs, you would absolutely defer, right? You would want the other team to have the ball first, so you knew exactly how many points you needed. So if you got an interception or you got, you know, whatever, that you knew you only had to play for a field goal, or you had to play for a touchdown because they missed the extra point, or they made their extra point and you may want to go for two. So the advantage is now going to be like college football, where it's going to swing to whoever gets to go second.
Yeah, it's just it's more things that are within your control, right? And I think that's what football coaches shoot for a lot, whether it's the extra possession with deferring to the second half or just whatever it is. Football coaches want to be in control. And I think that, with this setup the way that it is, I think that at least, Seth, is it if you go for two – and you get it, if you're the first team that gets the ball and you go for two and you get it, is the game over no matter what?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. I couldn't
remember. No, I don't think it is either.
That was also proposed in there at some point. I can't remember what team or where I heard that from. But then, yes, in this scenario where no matter what the other team gets the ball, you would want to get it second because, of course, you know exactly what you need to do.
Well, I think it's like the opening coin toss. You know, where teams defer on the opening coin toss because they want to see – they want the ball in the second half, right? So they want the ball in the second half of the game, and they're going to want the ball in the second possession of the game. And then I think there's going to be some interesting stuff where a team will say, hey, you know, like we do want the ball first because we want to put pressure on the other team because we feel confident. I mean, the Saints, I believe, for a lot of years under Peyton and Breeze would take – this is – again, this is different, but like they would take the ball first. They would not defer. They would take the opening kickoff because they felt like, hey, we can get a 7-0 lead in a ball game and give ourselves a chance to win it that way. So I think there's going to be some interesting gamesmanship about, I think deferring is the right way, but there can be some gamesmanship about who takes the ball first.
Yeah,
I tell you, the other thing that's really interesting is some of the proposals. I don't know if they're actually going through or not in the USFL. But there is a relationship between the NFL and the USFL now, in which I think they're going to try out some of these rule changes, and which ones they settle on, I'm not sure. But I do know that the possibility exists of a 1-point, 2-point, and 3-point extra point, which makes it very interesting, because now even an 18-point game is still a 2-score game. potentially, right? And from our standpoint on television, that's great. The longer you keep people engaged and still have a possibility of being able to do it. I'm going to guess the coaches aren't crazy about it because they hate those decisions where they can be blamed for losing the game and making the wrong choice. But basically, it's the same 1 point. If you want to go from the, go for it from the 2 yard line, that's the 2 point play, kick it from the 15 or whatever, that's the 1 point. Or from whatever yard line they choose, you know, the 10, the 12, whatever it is, that you could go for three. I got to admit, I kind of like that. I think that is a real possibility of the future of the NFL.
Yeah, anything that coaches that expands the variable, if you will, throughout the game, I mean, they're not going to like, because again, it's stuff that they can't control. But you know what you're talking about right now, Chris, is why I've for a long time, just like everybody else, I've wanted a legitimate spring football league or something that would be a step down from the NFL that isn't necessarily college football, because college is always going to feel like a different game in certain ways. But if you have that quote unquote B league or minor league ish to the NFL, that not only gets to hone the skills of a lot of players who might be able to then make a real jump to the NFL, who might get cut early on in their career or go undrafted or whatever. You get a bigger, more talented pool of players. You get to test out some rules, which I think is absolutely fantastic, because we've seen that the last couple of years with these new leagues. And then of course it's just more football, which people love anyways. And so those are three reasons that, and the rules included, are why I really want to see a league succeed under the NFL, not to challenge them, not to take them on, but to show us those little things that we could tweak about the game of football that might actually be really great changes in the long run that the NFL just probably wouldn't risk if they don't have to. So if they have another league that they might be able to test it out on, then that makes sense. We've seen leagues, super small leagues around the country and in Europe and in other countries, try this out. But unfortunately, the talent gap between them and the NFL is always so large that you go, okay, well, sure, that rule worked in this game, but we're talking about the best of the best in the NFL. Will the rule work the same? And if you get that talent gap a little bit closer, maybe you could tweak the game a little bit and find out some really fun stuff.
I'm all for it. I mean, you can kind of tell the theme that everything that I've said here, but I'm for all sorts of offensive plays. So if you want to add the ability to go for three and, you know, from, like you said, I don't know what the yard line, but it was the 12, the 15, whatever, the 10, I don't even know, then I'm all for it. Like anytime we can get more offensive plays, I'm all for it. And I think the other thing, like kind of like what Trevor is saying, is like the NFL football in general is going through this stage. We have been for a few years now of like safety, like trying to figure out how we can continue to play this game in a safe way. And a lot of the initiatives, let's say with like the XFL from a couple of years ago, and I'm sure I haven't looked at the USFL rules, but I'm sure with the USFL is like a lot of that for safety. Remember the kickoff rules changed in the XFL that were weird. But like, you know, the kickoffs are like one of the most dangerous plays in sports, basically. So, you know, trying to change that. And so I agree. I think like throwing stuff against the wall in these type of leagues, USFL, XFL, whatever, you know, I think there's going to be another XFL next year or something. I think that's great. Whether it's just for more offensive plays, for safety, for just more entertainment in the game. Like Chris, like you said, like, keeping an 18 point game is still manageable with like 5 minutes left in the fourth quarter.
Right. Which, like, right.
You know, like you said, I'm sure your bosses would love that.
We're good.
It also forces teams to keep their foot on the gas pedal, right? It doesn't allow teams to just sit back and go, oh, we've got an insurmountable lead. And I get that people would say like, that's part of the chess match, if you will, controlling the game, running the ball, keeping things less risk and keeping the clock moving. And I'm not totally opposed to that, but I'm just saying that if you were to expand how many points you could get after a touchdown, there's no doubt about it that the math totally changes and it forces teams to keep their foot on the gas pedal, which we've seen in the past. Sometimes when coaches don't do that, even though their intention is correct, they end up losing the game at the end because of, the clock hit zero and they just didn't get that possession back. So it would change the game a little bit, probably for a more exciting way.
And we're also talking about the possibility, and this is one that I've always advocated for, The onside kick is, you know, now with them having to start without the running start from 1 yard behind wherever the kickoff spot is, that the onside kick percentage is basically zero. It's probably 10, 15%. It used to be, you know, 35 or 40, whatever it was. And now they're talking about putting the ball on whatever yard line, let's call it the 35 yard line. And you want to go for it on fourth and 12, you can run your offense back out there. So no more onside kicks, but your offense, your quarterback, your receivers get the ball fourth and 12. You want to go for it, go for it. And it's like, make it, take it, you know, you right. pick it up, the ball is yours and let's go. So now even more 18 point lead is not safe. Now the possibility of you could score a 9 point play, come back and convert fourth and 12, score another 9 point play. You've made up right. 18 points. The other team's never touched the ball yet, you know? And so I don't know what that does to Vegas. I don't know what it does to gambling in general, but all hell's about to break loose.
Yeah.
I think my next proposal, well, first of all, I love that proposal. I think that makes the game super fun. Like you said, the onside kick is kind of useless now. Was once a very fun play. It's just not a fun play anymore. My next proposal is I think we should go full Canadian. I think we go three down, here unlimited motion, wide fields, 120 yards. If you want scoring, come down here, man.
Wait, in Canadian football, can as many people be in motion at one time? Is that what you said?
The eligible, except the offensive line, yeah.
Right. So that you the best part have, is, you just have people just really like running, just like doing crossers yeah. like behind the line of scrimmage yeah. before the snap.
The coolest part about it is, so back in the day when we would play, I used to always try to get them to put motion in. And like if you had a go route or a clearing route, I'm like, put me in motion and give me a run and start at this guy. Because if you're 6'4", you know, it's one of the dopiest things that football does anyway. No offense to Paul Brown who came up with this. But the 40-yard dash is all about being 5'5" and running the first 10 yards in a blink of the eye, right? So every small guy runs a fast your 40-yard dash than every tall guy. Usain Bolt was never ahead in the Olympic 100 meters at 40 yards because he's too tall. That's the way that whole thing works. So you've got all these different rules, and in the Canadian League, that guy, he can run from 15 yards deep and start running at the line of scrimmage. He might be 70 yards down the field. So a guy like Russell Wilson, who has this great deep ball, he might even be more unbelievable.
Well, it's funny because if you look at the receivers in Canada, the ones who play, you don't find the Cole Beasleys out there. Like those type of guys don't exist because they don't need to exist because you have the running start. So even in the slot, you have these big, tall receivers trying to make plays. Not all of them, obviously, but like you don't need those like quick Cole Beasley type players that kind of get into the routes from a standstill because you have this running start. Chris, am I crazy? Did I read somewhere that Montreal offered you a contract a long time
ago? They did. The Alouettes, when who was it? It was the guy that was for the Rams was playing quarterback up there back in the day.
Seth, this is all you. I'm not going to know this.
This is a little before my time, buddy.
Joe Ferragamo. And so he was up there. And so I was a second round draft pick. And of course, I was negotiating with the Bengals and they weren't going to pay me anything to be a second round draft pick. And so I was like, hey, you guys pay me this, I'm there. So I get on an airplane. I go up to Montreal. I'm a baby. I'm 22 years old. I have no idea about anything. I get off the airplane and everybody's speaking French. First of all, I had no idea that inside Canada is like this province that is, you know, everybody's speaking French. So the first English person came up to me with a camera. I'm literally just off the tarmac, you know, coming up here. I didn't know that anybody even liked football in Canada. They were just going to pay me more money than the Bengals and I was going to go. I didn't care. And so I get off. And so the first question I get asked was, how does it feel to take jobs away from Canadian citizens. And they put the microphone right in front of my face, right? Because I think you're only allowed like four or five Americans that could play at that time. And when I got hit with the, how does it feel to take away jobs from Canadian citizens? I was like, don't turn that plane off. I'm coming right back on there. I don't need this. I don't want this. This is not worth the dough that you're talking about. Let's get this over with. And so, but ultimately I did get the deal done with the Bengals.
The CFL had money to spend at that time. They went and got Johnny Rogers. They went and got Rocket Ismail. Like they paid people a lot. The NFL was not paying people like that.
Yeah, they took a shot. It was a little bit like the USFL and some of those world leagues. And they, you know, they got players and they got quarterbacks and they got all the different things that came out of it. So one other owner story for you. So I'm there with Nathaniel Hackett, and I know I've known Nathaniel. It's unbelievable, the guys that I see. So Nathaniel Hackett, the new head coach of the Denver Broncos, a lot of rumors that he was going to drag Aaron Rodgers out of Green Bay and go down there. It doesn't happen. And so then after all that happened, the general manager walks in and Patton and says, how would you feel about Russell Wilson? And here's Nathaniel Hackett, who's just missed out on Aaron Rodgers. And he goes, come on, are you serious, George? Are you asking me how I would feel about having Russell Wilson on my football team to start my first ever head coaching career here? Yes. Yeah. Let's go ahead and do this. So they sign him. And so we're at dinner last night. And so it was last night, Monday night. And it's, you know, and I know he's a West Coast guy, but it's 1 o'clock in the morning and we're doing the typical thing at the owners, and, you know, get something late to eat, a couple more drinks, a couple more stories. And, you know, everybody's kind of in the mood and having fun. And he goes, I want to show you something. He pulls out his cell phone and he has five different calls from Russell Wilson. He goes, this guy's relentless. It's unbelievable. Like everything in his mind is all about what's going on with the Denver Broncos. What are you thinking? What can I do? What are we going to, you know, and he's just one of those kind of personalities. And now we have a game out in the West right now, right? That AFC West is redonkulous, what that thing is going to be, the quarterback play that we're going to see. And I told Nathaniel, I don't know what's going to happen. You know, first year coaches, first year quarterback, all that kind of stuff, usually in a division like you guys have, means, you know, a 3-5 start. You know, that, again, let's be honest, that's usually what that's going to mean. And it may be that for you too. But what we learned a season ago is that the teams who had to slug their way through the toughest divisions were the ones that were kind of there at the end of the year. You know, the Bengals had a tough division coming out of it. Kansas City played in a tough West. The Rams played in such a tough in the NFC West. And so I told him, it doesn't matter where you finish. It doesn't matter if you're the Tennessee Titans and you had an easier division, so you had a couple of easier wins to come out of it. It matters where your football team is going into the playoffs, because there's only one bye week, and the team that had the bye weeks, they both got beat. So I'm not even sure that's an advantage anymore.
Yeah, the AFC, even beyond just the AFC West, is going to be an absolute slugfest all year long. I mean, like you said, Chris, even going back to last year, we weren't really talking about the Bengals a ton until, I don't know what, the last 3-4 weeks of the season. And we're like, okay, yeah, the Bengals could make it. And then obviously they make a noise, they make a run, they get to the Super Bowl. But I feel like that's what it's going to be in the AFC, is every single team that makes the playoffs from that conference is a legitimate Super Bowl contender. And there's going to be teams that do not make the playoffs in the AFC that you would say, there's going to be so many conversations of the number 8 team who just misses out on the playoffs from the AFC. And then people are going to be like, if that team was in the NFC, they'd be the number 2 or the number 3 seed. We were going to have that conversation.
We were going through it the other day, and you guys chime in where you want. I have 3 teams in the AFC that I don't think will make the playoffs. I don't think Houston will make it. I don't think Jacksonville will make it. And I don't think the Jets are quite ready to make it either, especially in those in that conference. Everybody else in the AFC, I think, has a chance, a legitimate chance to make the playoffs. I mean, it's insane because once you added Russell Wilson and Matt Ryan out of the NFC into the AFC, the quarterbacks that you're dealing with in that league are just, it's silly.
I think I'm interested to see the fallout of the teams that don't make it from this list of like, because like Trevor said, there's going to be, you know, the AFC West might have two teams that don't make it for sure. One, but maybe two teams that don't make it who are really good football teams and they don't make the playoffs. And I'm interested to see the fallout where you're going to look at it and say, okay, wait, did we not make the, are we a good team that we didn't make the playoffs because, you know, we had a turnover luck issue. We had a couple one score games that didn't go our way, you know, a field goal issue, whatever it is. And we're going to stay the course, or are we going to have a team like Denver who, you know, puts all their chips into the Russell Wilson basket. And let's say they don't make the playoffs and they say, oh, whoa, wait a minute. Like we got to change stuff now already. Or another team like the Colts, you know what I mean? Like they don't make the playoffs and they say, oh, this is not good. We got to change stuff again. Like, I think the fallout from whoever doesn't make the playoffs is going to be really interesting because you're going to have really, really good teams not make the playoffs again in the AFC.
Yeah,
and the NFC is everyone's laughing in the NFC. That's it's weird now.
You're totally right. I totally agree with you. And I think, you know, it's funny because when you lay it out like that, and like Chris says, there's really only 3-4 teams in the entire conference that you would say, okay, aren't going to make the playoffs. Everybody else is a contender. You would think that actually makes things a little bit easier, that decision makers and head coaches and things like that, they should have more patience. They should have more faith in their system, their process, if you will, that eventually they have the right team building there. They're going to make it happen. But we know that the NFL doesn't really operate like that naturally. So instead it could be the opposite way. It could be, okay, things are speeding up and shoot, man, maybe we're going to see some good GMs and good head coaches get fired over the next 2-3 years just because they get unlucky. Like you said, sometimes this game is such a thin margin between winning and losing. And if you string enough of those together, or if you lose enough of those, maybe you get booted. And you know, that we've seen teams in the past who, you know, like we've seen when Jim Caldwell got fired from the Lions, didn't he like have a 10-6 season, and almost like they, you know, the Lions were like, well, that's not enough. You can't get over the hump. Cause we hear about that all the time too. These teams that sometimes they're fully solidified as playoff teams, but they quote unquote can't get over the hump. I remember, I'm from just south of Tampa. I remember when that was Tony Dungy. Tony Dungy had built one of the best defenses in the NFL, but he could not get to the Super Bowl, and he ended up getting replaced by John Gruden because he couldn't get over the hump. Are we going to see these really good head coaches, whether they're making the playoffs or they're just not getting far enough in the AFC, get let go because they couldn't get over the hump? I think that's a conversation that we're going to have more of it.
Yes. Yes, the answer is yes. And I think Marty Schott and I went 14-2 one year and got fired, something ridiculous like that. The other thing that we talked about was, I said, don't forget that Von Miller had a strategically sound injury. So when you have an older player and he was out, remember when he got traded, he had the bad ankle. And so he was not a big part of what the Rams were doing when he first got traded. He had to get healthy and he had to figure out the system and he had to do, but when he got healthy and he had figured out the system, he had had basically a month plus off, and then he hit the playoffs running. So there's something to be said in this 17 game schedule and this massive playoff schedule that we now have without the two byes on the top end of it, of can you, like the NBA, can I get LeBron James to the starting line of the playoffs, which is a whole different story with LeBron James right now, but can I get my star players to the starting line to where they're fresh and they're ready to play their best football come playoff time?
That's also a big reason why, like, It's funny. I keep throwing out Odell's name to a lot of these contenders. Like the Packers are an example, right? I mean, Packers trade away Davante Adams, and I was immediately like, hey, I'd love for them to sign Odell. And Packers fans are immediately in my mentions saying, well, why would they do that? He's not going to play most of the season. Who cares? You see in the NFC, Green Bay is going to make the playoffs by Aaron Rodgers alone. They're going to make the playoffs. All they need is for Odell to be healthy in December and beyond. That's it. That's the only thing. And so, yeah, timing, people don't understand how important timing is to winning a Super Bowl and making these late runs. You're getting guys healthy. You've got so much chemistry with your players. You're clicking on all cylinders, if you will. That is so important, just as much as it is a lot of the team building that you do before the season as well. So I agree with you there, Joel.
I think you might even see more of it with quarterback position in terms of, and maybe this is not the best example, but you look at the Cardinals last year and they played a couple of games with Colt McCoy, and obviously Kyler Murray gets injured. It's not like they just held him out for no reason. He gets injured, but you feel more comfortable saying, this is a long haul now. We need him to be back at 100%. Like, we can't rush people back now because of this stuff. Now, again, not a great example because considering what happened once he came back in the lineup and where the Cardinals' season finished.
Right.
But I think you'll see that even with the most important players, just being able to say, and the quarterback is a special case, but I think with other positions, other elite players, you're going to see them. Again, if they're healthy, they're going to play, get it. But I think if they get an injury, you might see them take that extra week off to get back to 100% because we know how long the season is.
I think this is going to be fascinating to see how much of that happens in the NFC versus the opposite.
Everyone's taking on. Everyone's going to Michael Jordan's golf course
in the middle of the season. Opposite for the AFC. I think that you might see these teams try to rush these guys back as soon as possible because that margin is so slim. Whereas in the NFC, you're joking, but I mean, you're kind of not. Like, a guy might have an injury where you go, okay, normally you'd be out for a week, and they go, take 3 weeks off, take the PTO. It's all good. Just be healthy when December rolls around. And so that's going to be fascinating to watch too.
All right, last thing here today. I want you guys to take your favorite or most uncomfortable quarterback story coming out of this madness that was this season. And I think for me, it may well be Matt Ryan. I don't think Matt Ryan is finished. I don't think he's quite what he once was. But with the way that they can run the football – with the Colts, is Matt Ryan just the right fit to slide in there with Frank Reich? And so much of the play in the quarterback position is getting guys into the right run checks anyway at the line of scrimmage. I just feel like that's one of those that's sailing way underneath the radar screen right now that I think may end up being a little bit larger than life come next football season in arguably the weakest of the divisions, you know, because now with Miami and what they did with Tyreek Hill and fixing their offensive line to some extent are, you know, that one's going to be a little bit tougher there. So I'm going to take Matt Ryan and the Colts. Anything stick out to you guys?
Can I ask you guys, would you say Matt Ryan 2022 versus Philip Rivers 2019, was it the 1 year there? Who would you take? It's Matt Ryan, I think.
I would tell you that this is Indianapolis's best quarterback since Andrew Luck. That's what I would tell you. I think that this scenario right here is the best scenario they've had since Andrew Luck left. So I would totally agree with that. I think that, yeah, I mean, I hate how it ended in Atlanta for Matt Ryan. I mean, I think that whole situation was, I thought they did him dirty. I really did. I thought that this is a dude who's given, you know, 15 years to the organization, taking him to a Super Bowl, been an MVP caliber player. And just the way that it went down, where it was like, okay, they're pushing back his roster bonus just to make this stuff work. And then, you know, all the pop culture icons in the city are out here wanting a different quarterback. And I just felt it's not how Matt Ryan's time in Atlanta deserved to end for everything that he put up there. And you know what? It's not nearly to this extent, but I think the Baker situation kind of sucks too. I mean, granted, Cleveland upgraded at quarterback, and we figured that they were going to anyways, whether it was Russell Wilson or Aaron Rodgers or Jimmy Garoppolo, even, like, they were going to look for a different quarterback. But it's just the way that I feel like the whole Baker thing has been handled. He hasn't handled it perfectly either. I want to make that very clear. But it seems so weird that we're now in this place with Baker Mayfield, where last year, even midway through the year, with him playing hurt, we were talking about, is he a franchise quarterback? Do you sign him to the big deal? And now it's almost like the guy can't even get traded for a fifth round pick. And I think that we've gone a little bit too far in the other direction too, because I think Baker really hurt himself by playing hurt last year. No pun intended there. Like, I think that somebody should have looked at him and said, like, dude, you cannot play to the best of your abilities. Like, you've got to sit. And somebody, I wish, in Baker's camp would have gotten in front of him and told him, you are hurting yourself here.
It's a really good point, and it's a really dangerous thing in my mind for the league, because the precedent that's now been set is with Baker Mayfield, don't suck it up, especially if you're a quarterback, don't suck it up and try and finish the year. Because if you have a crappy year statistically, nobody's going to want you, and they're going to think that your career is over. He's had two bad years. He had last year with the shoulder, and he had 2 years ago with one of the worst offensive lines in football, or 3 years ago, whatever it was. And so he's kind of been good, bad, you know, like that. But I agree with you. I think the agents are going to start saying, my client is not playing for you, because look what happened to Baker Mayfield in Cleveland, who tried to suck it up and play through an injury.
Yeah.
I think his best thing to do right now. Now, obviously, if someone really wants to trade for him and, you know, let him be the quarterback of their team, sure, whatever. But I think the best thing, we're assuming that Deshaun Watson is suspended for however many games in his year one there in Cleveland, let's say somewhere between 4 and 8, I guess. You know, if you're Baker, you want to get your stock back up. It's stay in the same system, stay with Kevin Stefanski. You don't have to learn anything new. Play those 4 to 8 games, whatever it is, play well. Maybe you don't get traded in season, but at least once the season's over, now you have a 4-game sample size, whatever it is. You play good in 3 of those games, and now you're back to being a sought after quarterback. And I think that's like the best scenario for him. Like I said, in terms of not having to learn a new offense, having to have some comfort in terms of, you know, he's already been there. He literally still plays for the Cleveland Browns. So, like, you know, and looks like they're going to go and find some, they're hopeful to go find some better receivers, whether it's in the draft or still in free agency. So I think that's the best for him. And then just kind of like get his stock back up by just sucking it up to a certain degree and knowing you're only going to, even if you are the best quarterback in the league after 4 games, you're done, it's over. But knowing that and just kind of get your stock back up that way.
I think that that's definitely the best case scenario for Baker. I would be so curious to hear whether the Browns would even entertain that, because obviously, like, if you have a quarterback like Baker Mayfield who already knows the system and everything or whatever that you could plug in while Watson is being suspended, that helps you. But at the same time, if Mayfield plays well, there are already people who are not happy with Cleveland for even doing what they did, not just with Baker, but with bringing Deshaun Watson in. Cleveland just signed Deshaun Watson to a fully guaranteed $230 million. Would they rather cut Baker Mayfield and eat the $18 million than risk potentially putting their franchise in turmoil? If let's say it's an 8-game suspension for Deshaun and Baker balls out. Let's say this team, because they are a talented football team, right? Let's say they're 7-1. Let's say they're 6-2. Baker Mayfield
I'm into it.
Has
I
them.
Love it.
Baker Mayfield has them as the number one seed in the AFC. You think they're just going to give the reins back to a guy who people already publicly criticized that they even went after? But they,
yes, they will. Yes.
No, I know, I know, but they already owe this guy. It's just, I'm just thinking of like what could happen with all this.
No, for sure. Well. But it's the best case scenario that if that right now you're getting no value out of Baker, right? If Baker comes out and goes 3-1 to start next year, 4-1, whatever the case may be, and they could, that's a really good football team. Then now you still before the trade deadline, now you might get that first round draft pick. If Matthew Stafford gets hurt with the Rams and they don't feel comfortable, you might get a number one. Right now, you may not get anything. They're talking about that the Browns would have to throw in a draft pick to get rid of him. Of course I'm going to play. Who am I going to play if I don't play Baker the first 8 games?
I hear you, and I do think that, of course, that is an added plus, is that you up the trade value. Now he's worth something. Now you get back in return. But what if Watson then struggles? You know what I'm saying? And then, like, all of a sudden, Cleveland's screwed. They just signed this guy to a tour. That's why I'm thinking in my head, like, the mad scientist, the theorist in my head is like, would I rather eat the 18 mil, just cut him, and let no one have any of that imagination whatsoever? Like, don't even risk it. Like, Deshaun, we're paying Deshaun. Deshaun's the guy. He's going to get suspended. He's going to come back. That's it. There's nothing else to think about. I don't know.
I still think he ends up in Seattle. It makes too much sense for him to land in Seattle, them draft a quarterback, sit behind Baker, give it a go. If Baker's good, great. We'll be able to do it. But it's so similar to the style of play that Russell Wilson has that you're not going to have to change everything on the offensive side of the ball. You get Pete Carroll back in there now as the defensive coordinator, de facto defensive coordinator on that side of the ball. And I could see them winning 10 games with that bunch and making the playoffs. I mean, that's not out of the question. I don't see Carolina doing the same thing. I think Carolina will end up drafting somebody.
Yeah, I tend to agree there.
With Carolina, I wonder how gun-shy they are after the Sam Darnold experience went so bad so quickly that they're like, you know what, let's just reset the whole thing. It's tough. I understand, like, NFL teams don't want to do that. Like, it's always easy for us to, like, sit back here, like, not being a part of a team and be like, well, just reset the whole thing, just tank and reset it. And I know that NFL teams, when you're there, your job is on the line, and you don't think like that. And I get that. But yeah, I think bringing him to Seattle, let him compete with Drew Lock, two quarterbacks that we've seen flashes from, certainly more from Baker, and just let him compete, and hopefully the best guy wins it, and you can get a few wins. And like we said, the NFC is not very strong, so why not?
Well, Malik Willis is probably going to get drafted by Carolina, and then they're going to, but he's going to be a project, you know. I mean, there's no doubt. And the formula has been, all right, let's Justin Herbert, Josh Allen, let's take the bigger, stronger, better athlete and teach him how to play quarterback. And that would be Malik Willis in this class.
Sure.
But remember how long it took for those guys to get it going too. You know, especially Josh Allen, and they may not have that long in Carolina. At least if you have Baker down there, you buy a little time. Maybe you can get to 10 wins like we're talking about Seattle. But I think the easier path, even though a much tougher division, would be Seattle. I think that's a plug and play, and they're going to try and grind away on it. And I don't see Seattle drafting a quarterback this year. That just makes no sense to me at all, but maybe they will. Who knows?
I agree. It would be hard to justify Pete Carroll, one of the oldest head coaches in the NFL, trading away Russell Wilson just to draft a quarterback who is not ready to play for him right away. It just seems like an odd use of resources for him to be.
Or draft him and then let Baker play this year and let somebody else train underneath him and see what Baker does. I'm telling you, I think completely writing off Baker Mayfield at this point is a mistake. I think he is being very much underestimated because two of the 4 years that he played very well. And two of the years that he did not play very well, he had legitimate excuses. In my mind, he had legitimate excuses, the horrible offensive line and the left shoulder. So we shall see. Gentlemen, it has been a pleasure. And it's nice of you, Trevor, to clean up the kitchen a little bit before we started this whole thing. That's good stuff.
It gives me an excuse to not live like a slob anymore. So I appreciate that, Chris.
Yeah. Well, and Seth, we hope you take a shower sometime soon. Anymore. We don't care. We're good.